Dad's clearance. Have a great show.
Welcome to Absolute Scenes, a new podcast by myself, Andy Barton.
And myself, Gabrielle Shepherd.
We are, I'll say live, we're brought to you in association with the Bristol Old Vic Theatre and actually coming out of the Bristol Old Vic Theatre.
These genuine walls.
Yeah, that's what we're hitting as the from behind
so
us.
So if you do hear any, you know, dramatic screaming, hand dryers, that's because we're in a real working building.
Yeah, it's we're yet to have a functioning studio, or even any studio, functioning or otherwise. We're here basically to peek behind the curtain and give you a little look into what the entertainment industry holds for us, mm-hmm. what it holds for
our guests,
and we've got many coming over the next few weeks, ranging from actors, casting directors,
magicians.
Yeah, we've got illusionists coming on. We also have artistic directors of theatres as well, and it's the idea is that we want to hear their lives as being a creative and what it's like to be a creative.
The good, the bad and the ugly.
Yeah,
all of it.
Definitely the ugly. That's the good stuff.
The juicy stuff.
But also, and the reason really why we're called as we are called, is where we hear about their absolute scene, which is really their scene from a film, from a TV show or a play that has inspired them to do what they do. Or maybe in the times of where they have a block within their creativity that they return to try and find inspiration.
Yeah.
And it can also be something that it may not even be a film or a scene from a film or a TV show or play. It may even be just a chapter from a book or a song. So that's it. That's the reason why we're called Absolute Scenes. And also for anyone who is a sports fan, I've just stolen it from Absolute Scenes, Jeff, as well. If you've tuned in thinking that this is a sports punditry...
Sorry to disappoint.
But hopefully you might stick around because you might just be like, oh, okay, well, these people talking about acting and directing or theatre. But it's not just about theatre. It's also about other things as well, but mainly about the entertainment industry. Maybe you might just be interested to hear our voices drone on about these things. But please stay. Have a listen. We'll be with you.
Some crazy stories as well.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what we're here to do. And we're going to be interested to hear your thoughts around this as well. We're interested to hear your questions. We're interested to hear your feedback.
Anyone you would like us to get on, maybe any particular job role you'd like to get on.
Yep. Send it in.
theabsolutescenespodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. I don't know if this is the right thing for me to say, but why not? I also work at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre in reception. So, I mean... I'm always around. Pop in, say hello. I mean, we'll do this face-to-face, and that's also cool. I'm okay with that. So this episode is around acting, and it's around
I would say and writing. Kind of making your own work a little. It kind of touches on all of those things, I would say.
And being an actor, of which we both are, is a funny and weird career.
That's a very gentle way of putting it.
Yeah, very generous way. And Psychat's journey is an interesting one. He definitely sort of goes into it and touches on it. And I mean, my own journey has been a very strange one, especially starting at 32. So a bit of a late bloomer with the industry. But I think it's one that I enjoy. But it's also, and the reality is though, it's one that I find deeply frustrating at times as well. Mm-hmm. And I have had to, over at least the last 7 or 8 years, I think in the first 18 months, I was very starry-eyed and like full of hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
Oh, you could, oh my God.
But you're young and you're full of vigour and energy, and now we're old and jaded.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess it's around reminding myself of the joys of why I do it, and that I do enjoy doing it. Mm. There was a reason why I left my former job, and I'm in this for life now, and I am, and I do it because I like making art. I enjoy acting. I think I'm all right at it. I think I'm okay.
I think you're all right.
I think I'm
okay. Yeah, you're all right.
And I honestly think that, like, anyone who's thinking of getting, whether you are 12, 22, 32, or 62.
85.
Yeah.
It's never too late.
Do it. Absolutely do it. And that goes for whether you're doing it from an amateur dramatics group. If you're involved in a local community group. I used to do, when I was, it was my mum who got me into acting when I was 10 years old. Yeah, cheers, mum. Doing Humpty Dumpty.
Oh, was that your first?
My first one.
Mine was The Jolly Postman.
Oh, okay. Ooh. Talk to me about that.
Oh, okay. So at primary school, we were putting on The Jolly Postman. Actually, this is kind of a foreshadowing. Like, I generally love to gender bend characters.
Nice.
And I was definitely a male postman.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe that was the beginning for me. But yeah, basically I played this character that used to, he just went round all the villages and said hi to everyone and delivered everyone's mail. And everyone was like, wow, she was so good. And I was like, this is it.
Love it.
I'm born to perform.
I love it.
Also had a great hat.
Oh.
And a great, like, bag full of post.
And
I do still love a side satchel. So maybe that's me. I've just become the jolly postman.
Is that something that you'd be curious to revisit?
Is this?
As a
do role? I need to pitch this as a one-woman show? A drag jolly postman.
Oh, hello.
I'm there. Okay.
Watch. I mean, right, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can.
Well,
get
no.
You
I
on.
Mean, it doesn't need me to.
We can get you gender bending. Me gender. It's going to be great.
Great. Yeah.
All right. Well, I already have three projects in my head on the go. So why not add a fourth?
Classic.
Great.
what got me into acting? I was 10 years old. I think I'd already done. There'd already been at school, there's been some like nativity play type things. And so everyone's sort of involved in that. And that was quite cool and stuff anyway. But the one, my mum was part of an amateur dramatic, Stane Street Players. I'm going to name check them. I should. My mum, Heather, hi Heather, was part of them. And and we were doing Humpty Dumpty. And they needed extra chorus members, and it was at the Earl's Cone Village Hall. Mum got me, I can't remember if she got my brother, because my brother would have been 8 at the time, but I was 10, so I remember I was in it. But we'd done a few rehearsals, we'd already gone to quite a few rehearsals anyway, and I was sort of in the chorus. And the opening was a take on Oklahoma, the song, but it was...
Okay.
Egg Dorado. So 10 years old, and this is, and I'm right at the front. So I'm, the curtains will open, and I'm right at the front. Now, the way that we've been, the costume, bearing in mind this is an amateur dramatics, okay, mm-hmm. We had these primary coloured tunics. Mine was yellow, and it went down to just below Little Andy and my groin.
Mm-hmm.
And
any trousers, tights?
Oh, you have black tights. So I had these black tights.
Okay.
But the bottom, the hem of the tunic went to the bottom, literally just below me.
Only just. Okay.
And the thing was that you had to, with the opening line of Egg Dorado, the opening moves was that we all had to, as a chorus, raise our arms up fully to the sky, going, Egg Dorado. And you won't be able to see this, but I'm like raising my arms right to the sky with each movement. And it would rise the tunic up. Fine, because it's like black tights and stuff. But the other thing is that Jennifer... who was the director, unfortunately she's no longer with us anymore, but Jennifer was the director, she said and reminded everybody, wear dark underpants because of the UV lights.
I think I know where this is going.
Yeah, you do know where this is going. I did not, and I forgot to wear dark underpants. I mean, I'm only 10 years old, and I forgot to wear dark underpants. And so...
That sounds to me like that's on Heather.
Oh no, we can't say this. But it wasn't on you, it's okay.
We love you, ma'am.
And so I had to go commando. Because of
no.
The Yeah. So I had to go commando to
oh, no.
So because the UV lights would have shown up my white underpants beneath the black tights. But knowing about this, I was worried that because my arms were going to be rising above my head, and the tunic rising up, that I didn't want everyone to be seeing Little Andy during Egg the Rado where the sun shines. But
of course,
so,
yeah.
So when the curtains came up, I just went like a T-Rex and my arms just went Egg the Rado where the sun shines. And that was my opening.
Is there
my
a clip
opening.
Of this somewhere?
There is no. Oh, is there? I don't know.
Oh, please find no, it. If
it'll
you
be a VHS.
We will share
right.
it on social media.
You've got
media.
To remember, this was 1991.
Hey, VHSs were around.
So that was 1991, Christmas. So I'd been nearly 10 years old. So Christmas 1991, that was.
On that note.
Yeah, sorry.
Now
I was just,
you know where we came from.
That's where we came from. So
let's join our guest, Saikat, and hear where he came from, his journey. I'm so excited for you to listen to this and meet him. He is just incredible and a genuinely lovely man. So enjoy.
And now we move on to our favourite part of the show, which is a bit weird because it's actually the first time we've done it.
But, no pressure.
But I'm very excited to introduce our guest for today. You might remember him from such recent stage productions as Arabian Nights or Child of Science, the television series Monday Monday, and such feature films as East is East and the Disney live-action Aladdin. It's actor, writer, and all-round gorgeous human, Saikat Ahmed!
Oh, thank you. Oh, I'm blushing.
Thank you very much for coming today and
nice,
being with
pleasure.
Us. So Gabrielle and I, we decided that we're going to sort of start...
with the really important questions. Yeah.
Oh.
And the very first important question is a would you rather question.
Okay.
Mm. Now, we think that this one is appropriate for yourself. We think you'll like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is, would you rather have Wolverine's claws, but they're permanently extended all the time?
Storm's control over the weather, but you have a permanent rain cloud over your head, which you can't get rid of.
I'd go storm, definitely. I mean, I love the rain. I absolutely love the rain. Considering my heritage is South Asian, I'm not very good with the sun. I mean, it's a point
as
of
in
real.
Like in your head or on your skin or like
on my,
just
on
everywhere.
My skin, it doesn't get in my head.
It doesn't play mind games.
No, I get very hot very quickly.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll say things like, "Oh my god, this weather," and
my
wife will look at me and go, "Oh, it's very mild."
Yeah.
is that just because it's a British thing and you just feel like you need to comment on the weather all the time?
Literal heat. So since I was a kid, so I remember we went to Bangladesh a lot when I was a child, and I mean that was insufferable in terms of the heat. It was just too much, and there's no kind of knowledge here, there's no medical backing, but I can't, a part of my brain thinks, yeah, that it just damaged me, because I had one particular holiday where I just burnt, and instead of going darker, I went white. My skin started blotching, and I was like, oh, this is horrible.
That sounds really painful.
It was. I was probably 8 or 9. And since then, it's like, as soon as the sun's out, I'm like, oh, the sun's out, I better go inside.
Goodbye, vitamin D.
Yes.
I mean, this is amazing because when I had a thought about this would you rather question, because I thought, obviously, conversations that we've had over the months and year or so since we've known each other, I thought you'd sort of quite like it because of what I know about you. But also... this is not the answer that I ever...
No, of course, no, of course not.
And I love it. This is amazing.
I also love the fact that you've essentially got a sun hat on now.
Yeah.
Indoors.
Well, there's a window. Protection at all costs. I love Wolverine. I love superheroes, as you know.
Mm. I wouldn't have guessed.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
He is covered in
Marvel, X-Men, Captain America memorabilia.
Yeah, Captain America t-shirts and X-Men.
I might have told you this if I haven't, I'm about to.
Great.
A couple of years ago, I went to Comic-Con in San Diego. Have I told you this? I made a costume and I dressed up and I walked
Storm.
Around. No, as Captain Bangladesh.
Love it.
So I made...
Is there photographic evidence of
this? Yeah, I've got photographic evidence.
Okay, we're
going to
need that later.
I basically took a template of Captain America, but then it was green and red, and it had, you know, the flag in various places, and I etched onto a buckle on the belt, 1971, which was the time of independence.
Oh, and amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. And what was funny was so many people came up to me and was like, hey, can we have a photo? Yeah, yeah, sure. And they'd walk away going, I had no idea who that was.
But he looked amazing.
Yeah. I think he's like green and red man.
Yeah. I think this will link this on the Insta. Yeah. Is a definite definite thing for the socials. there's me trying to.
Wish I hadn't told this story.
I'm also a serious actor.
We wanted to get you in today because really to sort of talk about your career and your life as an actor, as a writer as well, because
you kind of do everything. How would you define yourself? Actually,
that's a really good question. For a while, I used the term theatre maker, but actually,
yeah,
now I've kind of, I think I've gone with actor writer,
yeah,
or actor and writer.
It feels a little bit more official and posh.
Yeah, I mean, because the theatre maker,
it's so broad, right?
You know, it's really broad, and we're all theatre makers, and we all exist in that space. But actually, you know, if you're talking about marketing yourself, then it's like, what are the skills that you bring? Well, I do dramaturgy, I've done some directing, but actually, generally, in terms of the work that I'm going to get, it's either going to be as an actor or it's going to be as a writer.
Mm. Yeah.
Or associated areas.
And then your theatre making is more kind of like your personal work, I guess?
Well,
which means
yeah,
you're
possibly
going to be making that,
yeah,
not being
the,
hired.
Yeah, yeah. It, so the solo work that I've done, I guess, could be theatre maker, but also I wrote those shows, I acted in those shows, so it still holds true. The theatre maker thing is interesting because I, in my mind, actually what that goes towards is more the collaborative devising and being in a space with other actors and we're collectively making something together. But also, if you're not in the industry, theatre maker is like, oh, do you build rooms for hospitals?
That's a really good point.
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah.
So
actually, that was a question I had for you as well. It's if in a parallel life, because obviously you come from a family of doctors.
I do.
And also you studied journalism.
I did, yes.
What do you think you would be if you weren't an actor?
That's a very good question. Well,
a theatre maker.
Yeah, a theatre maker, yes.
Specifically
no,
in a hospital.
So for a while, medicine was... Mm. You know, on the cards. My father's practice was in the same building where we lived. It was part of the house. And actually, I think as a young child, looking back, I think it was a way of connecting with my dad. And, you know, I used to say, well, one day you're going to have to put up a plaque that is Dr. Ahmed and son. We'll both be doctors, so it'll be Dr. Ahmed and Dr. Ahmed and all that kind of stuff. And actually, for a while, I really was thinking that was the route.
Yeah.
And it was only, it was probably when I was sort of going into A-levels that I suddenly had a thought of, oh, I don't really enjoy science as much as actually what I chose was Latin, ancient Greek, English. You know, it was those...
Actually, setting up for writing at that.
Setting up for writing, but actually probably... With ancient history, with ancient Greek, with Latin and English, what it really was in some way or another, it was all about stories.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, ancient history, if you're talking about, you know, the Greek civilization, if you're talking about, you know, Roman Empire with Julius Caesar, they are the best stories.
Yeah. I always come back to them.
Yeah.
Was there a particular one that do you think... was the genesis of your...
Well, I really felt as a kid, there was part of the thing that we learnt about was the triumvirate, which was, oh God, this I'm now going to forget. I think it was Julius Caesar, Octavius and Marcus Licinius Crassus. And they basically came together as a kind of trinity of politicians and did all these deals in the background. And even as a young kid, I was probably not a young kid, I was about 16. I was like, this is like a thriller.
Yeah.
This is amazing. Yeah. And then you've got ridiculous tales of, like, you know, emperors who married their horses or horrific tales of Constantine, the Emperor Constantine ended up boiling his mother
Horrendous.
In a bath of, you know, which is the first case of, what was it, boiling the bag chicken or whatever. terrible. But actually, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
And these, and who knows how much truth there is, but because you see different versions. But very early on, I suddenly realized that the thing that really gets me excited is stories.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I'm exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's not just stories for the sake of stories. It's stories are a way of A, understanding the world, understanding ourselves, creating empathy, creating understanding between different people, bridging different cultures. You know, it's really fundamental things. Like, so I wrote a show a number of years ago called Strictly Ballsy.
Yeah.
And that was commissioned as a kind of, okay, we want something about the second generation experience of being an immigrant. Okay, yeah, I can do that. But the story I ended up writing seemed to resonate with a lot of people. You know, we took the show in its early stages into some secondary schools, and I remember we were at St. Mary Redcliffe in Bristol, and one of the students, who was a young girl, came up to me and said, you've written a show about my life.
Oh, really?
There was also, we took it to Edinburgh, and there was this woman who'd come over from America, and she'd lost her dad a few years before, and she grabbed me after the show and said, oh, can I sit and talk to you for 5 minutes? We ended up sitting for 2 hours, her husband, and just talking about her relationship with her dad. And it's like, well, that's what stories do.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's what theatre does. That's what theatre can do.
Mm.
You know, don't get me wrong, I love entertaining an audience and I love being entertained.
Yeah.
But if you can
do both,
or if you can actually make some sort of switch where people are like, yeah, in some way, that's going to stay with me for the rest of my life. It's kind of alchemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you
and
know
actually,
I mean?
You have to have different levels of everything. To have a really great comedy, you need drama. To have drama, because otherwise it's just one thing the whole
light
time.
And dark.
So it's exactly the same with story and, you know.
So talking about Strictly Ballsy as well, obviously it was incredibly important for you on a personal level for that to be made. As a performer, theatre maker, actor, writer, how was it difficult or was it easy to get it made? I don't necessarily mean on a emotional level, but obviously you absolutely go into that, but on a functional level of making something.
Also, specifically, how long, just for the listeners, how long ago it was?
Oh, yeah.
When was it you were making
it? Good question. So I believe Strictly Ballsy was 2015. Something like that. It was around that.
When I was doing some research.
Around about that ballpark. So actually, it was very. I mean, this isn't typical. It was very easy to get it made because actually, what happened was I was very fortunate. So I made a show called The Tiger and the Moustache, and that was really difficult to make. And I did it. I literally did everything myself, apart from Benji Bauer made some tracks for me. And most of the tracks were actually just sound effects and stuff, but there was, he did a version of Heaven, We're in Heaven. But he did it on the sitar.
Oh, really?
Because I had a bit in the show where suddenly you had this strange hybrid of cultures. But apart from that, I did everything myself. I made the set myself, I literally found furniture in Skips, took it, sanded it down, painted it black.
Yeah, yeah.
Costume was what I had in my wardrobe.
That sounds like real theatre. Like, oh, that's yeah, so... I think a lot of people will relate to that. Like, yeah. We've all done that.
And it wasn't... I wasn't doing that as a choice. You know, it was partly I had no money.
Yeah.
But also, I had no knowledge. So I was like, oh, I want to write this show. Okay, I'll sit down and I'll write it. And I remember I wrote the show, and it was initially called Bangladesh, but I was informed by my wife, that sounds a bit worthy. So she was totally right. And I wrote the play in a week in between shows while I was doing, I think it was Cinderella at Tobacco Factory. So I basically, people would come in for the morning show for the school.
Yeah.
And then they'd disappear and then come back and for the evening show. And I just stayed in the dressing room and just wrote and wrote and wrote. So I wrote the piece and I was like, right, I've got that. And I presented it at Ferment at Bristol Vic as Bangladesh. And then I thought, right, I've done it now. I've written it. What do I do now? Oh, I need... So it got booked into Tobacco Factory. And I think... I can't remember. I think either played a week or I played 3 days. And that went really well. And then the next year I thought, right, I want to take it on tour. Mm. I've never organised that. Yeah. It can't be that difficult. So
all the producers listening being like, yeah, okay.
And what I mean, hats off to all the producers.
Yeah.
I got Spotlight, and I just, you know, back when you had a physical copy of Spotlight, and I just kind of went, right, I'll write to all the venues. In the end, I wrote to about 100, 120 venues. I sent them, you know, a clip that I'd recorded. I sent them a spec of what it was. And I remember the first phone call was Damien Cruden at the Theatre Royal York. And he phoned up and said, yeah, that looks interesting. We want to book it. What?
Really?
Are you sure? We want to book it. So what's the fee?
£10.
Nice. And I kind of went, I don't know, what do you normally pay? At which point I'm sure he was like, I'm gonna get this for a steal.
Yes.
And he did. But
that's part of it. It's a learning process, right? Was, so you were learning for the first time.
Totally learning. So sorry, I've gone off piste, but actually I presented that, and when I took it to I think I brought it back to Tobacco Factory, and Jude Merrill, who used to run Travelling Light, saw it. And she said, oh, can we take this into schools?
Mm.
And I said, no, I'll write you something new. And so she commissioned Strictly Ballsy.
You were given the resources for Strictly Ballsy.
Yeah. Nice. And they put everything in place. Sally Cookson directed, Katie Sykes designed, Pete Judge did the music. I mean, it was amazing. It was also, on an artistic level, it was really interesting to go from doing Tiger and Moustache literally on my own, you know.
So you didn't have a director, you didn't have... No, it was just you.
It was so naive that it was like, well, I've written it. I know what I want to do with those words. I know what the moves are, because the moves are instinctive.
Yeah, of course,
And it was kind of somewhere between theatre and a piece of storytelling. So it was, you know, no one's ever directed me storytelling.
Mm.
I just get up and do it. So it was kind of that same sensibility. So to go from that to suddenly being surrounded by creatives who've all got an opinion about something that's very personal was actually amazing, because, you know, they only made it better. Do you know what I mean?
Was there any, like, resistance
yourself?
Oh, yeah. I've
got such a big ego. He has been such a diva.
There's a bowl of blue M&Ms. Like, how did you deal with that resistance?
So there was a whole thread in the play, which I think was to do with a tree, right? So without, you know, hopefully some people listening might have seen the show, but if you haven't, it's basically a story of my childhood and me growing up and clashing with my parents and how I kind of found a bit of peace and a bit of understanding of what they'd gone through. And one of the things that happens very early on is my dad gives me a book of poetry, and in there by Rabindranath Tagore, who is the great poet of the Bengali language, or one of the great poets. And I start reciting this poem. And it's basically saying this tree standing on one leg is stretching to the sky, yearns to be free. It stretches its fronds out to the sky, but it never can be because it's rooted. So it's like it kind of has parallels with migration and belonging, all these things. So I had this thread all through the script. And quite late in rehearsals, Sally said, yeah, I think we just need to get rid of that. I was like, whoa. But it's so poetic.
Yeah. And that's when Sally was kicked off the project.
Yes, and she's never worked since. Where is she now?
Where is she?
No, but she was absolutely right. She was right. Or actually, right doesn't come into it. It's not right or wrong.
No.
You have to give that trust.
It's hold on tightly, let go lightly, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also that thing of, I remember, I think it was Miranda Cromwell that said this to me, and she used to say, what ends up in the cutting room floor is a testament to the show. So the more beautiful and amazing things you've got that you didn't put in, actually it shows how incredible the show is.
Yeah, definitely. And also, even if you don't use something in terms of a draft that you've written or a choice that you've made as an actor, that doesn't matter because having gone through that process has informed something.
Yeah, 100%.
So, you know, so actually that thread may not be there for the audience, but it's there in my performance.
You're playing it emotionally.
I mean, also, I love people. I love people. And so it was such a joy to be in a room working on something that I was really passionate about with people that I trusted and people that I loved.
And I imagine it's a yes, but are those the people that you look for the most to work with? Like, what in a person do you look for when you work with them?
Yes and no. So everyone I've named, yes, I'd work with in a heartbeat. But also one of the things that excites me is working with new people. You know, the show that I'm doing at the moment, Child of Science, there's no one in the cast or the creative team that I've ever worked with apart from the associate director Alex. We worked together on something just before, but actually it's really great meeting new people because, you know, You're potentially making friends for life, but even if you're not, you're making people. You're meeting people who hopefully, in some way, will enrich your life for the rest of your life.
You learn
so much. You see what they're going through. You creatively break bread together, and that's useful.
It's a very intense experience as well, isn't it? You sort of like become a family, and then you just do. Sometimes you just lose each other, and that's fine.
But it takes some getting used to, because my first few jobs when I was straight out of drama school, I was like, oh my God, I've met these people. We're like family.
Yeah.
And then the show finishes on a Saturday, Monday, and this is years before WhatsApp groups. You know, this is years before actually smartphones.
It was still carrier pigeon vibes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like smoke signals. But actually, suddenly they fall off the radar, and it's because they've all gone off to do other things, and that and for the first few times it was heartbreaking.
Do you get post-show blues?
It depends on the show.
Yeah,
depends on the show. I don't get them as badly as I used to. When I did Peter Pan, when we finished at the National, that was really hard.
Was that the first time you'd been at the National?
Only time. So it was a big, if you're listening, Indu,
I'm available.
I'm available.
We're all available.
From a week on Saturday. that was tough. But also there was stuff going on in my life that was made it tougher. But actually, I don't get those post-show blues anymore, I don't think, because I've kind of you know, maybe it's getting older, I've taken a step back and I try and see the bigger picture.
That's really beautiful.
Well, it's like...
And how... Yeah, because I imagine a lot of people have this question that are in the arts. How do you do that? Like, how do you... Mm. What's that shift?
Well, I think part of it is age, part of it is... A lot of it's to do with perspective. So in my early 20s, right through into my 30s probably, acting was everything. You know, it's like it consumed me.
It was like a hold on your heart.
Yeah, a hold on your heart. And it wasn't just the nice stuff, which is the creative stuff. It was also the business side. It was like getting to that ladder, doing that thing, getting in, seen by that, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then, you know, becoming a parent, getting married, you know, losing my father, all those things gave me a shift and made me think, oh, I love this. But it turns out there's other stuff in life. And actually, and I'm genuinely not saying this to make a point. This is absolutely true and perhaps goes against the idea of this podcast. But when I look back on my life, it's very, very rare that I think of, oh, that moment on stage or even that moment in the rehearsal room.
Yeah, that's fair.
I only ever think about, oh my God, the first time my boy walked or, you know, that holiday I had with my wife or that, oh God, that crazy night I had with my mates, you know, where we drank too much and we ended up, I don't know where we ended up, you know, it's that's the stuff that sticks with me.
But I think that's a really good point because so often we hear people being like, don't let acting be the only focus of your life. Don't let acting, like you have to have other things. And I think I'm currently in a place where I find that really difficult. And I have other things in my life that I absolutely love, but I still find it. So that's really interesting to hear that it's changed.
It does change. It does. I mean, I don't know if it changes for everyone, but it changed for me. And also, you know, an interesting way of kind of almost visualizing it is rather than thinking you're, you know, a job is like a movie, you know, so I'm not saying literally a movie, but say you're doing a theatre job. If you visualise it as, oh, we've come to the dramatic end. Oh, it's all over. Well, it's not. It's a TV series and there's always another episode. Always, while you're alive, there's always another episode. So it's not over.
Yeah. And actually, this in terms of your career as a whole, would you say that's become like... I don't know if this is true. From the outside, it seems like you do very well to like have a job available for the next time. Yeah. Would you say as that's true? And would you say that's helped you feel more calm and see the bigger picture? Like, how was it when you were more at the beginning of career?
That's a really good point. So, I mean, it's something I think about a lot, actually, that I think from the outside, it probably looks like I go from job to job to job.
I think we all look at each other and see that.
Yeah, I mean, that's comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah, exactly.
We all do it. I'm guilty.
Yeah, we're all guilty of that. I don't, but I also have to be honest and recognise that I've been incredibly fortunate. And, you know, I've had years where it's like, oh, I'm on a really good run. And then I've had years where it's like,
Will
I ever act
again? Yeah.
And, you know, I nearly gave it up back in probably 2007, 2006.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was having a really terrible year. Nothing was coming through.
When did you graduate? Just so I can
get a perspective on... I graduated in 99.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not that long. I mean, I say that long, but not that long after you graduated. No.
7 year itch.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I think it was also, it wasn't just that. It was like, I had kids and I had responsibilities.
Yeah, of course.
Well, not even, is there more to life? It was more like,
How to pay the bills.
Yeah. Oh my God. You know, when I was in my early 20s, it was like, how to pay the bills? Well, I guess I'm not paying that bill. And I'm not advocating that.
And I'm still
it
on the run.
Only leads to dismay. But, you know, it was like, I could get by with very little.
Yeah.
As long as I had, you know, enough money to get a bit of food and
this is
pay my bills.
Pre, yeah.
pre-kids. Yeah. I could, you know, before I got together with my wife, I hadn't had a single holiday in my adult life. And that wasn't, I mean, it didn't even occur to me. Why would I go on holiday when I could be working?
I'm the same. Yeah. I'm like, well, they, and also if I book not, one, I'll get not a healthy. Job. No, it's not healthy at all.
It's not healthy. And and actually, sometimes it's good to have someone else in your life saying it's not healthy.
Yeah.
You know. But actually, yeah, it's ups and downs. But now the ups are never too high and the downs are never too low because I've taken a step back.
Yeah.
So it's like... I got offered a gig. Well, I got penciled for a gig this week, and it was like it's a commercial.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, the week we're looking at is this week. Are you fully available? Well, no, I'm not. I've got 2 days where I'm not available. The other 3 days you can do what you like with, you can. But those 2 days, I've got my son's graduation, and the day after, I'm just spending with him. Oh, well, they've come back and they've said they might not be able to use you. They might have to release a pencil. Well, 10 years ago, I might have been full of angst.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, oh, fine.
Yeah. That's more important.
Yeah, it's more important. Now, don't get me wrong. There's lots of nuance within this. If it was something where it was like, okay, it's £50,000. Or if Scorsese wants to have a meeting with you because, well, he probably wouldn't do that. I'm not really his casting type.
We're manifesting this at some point.
Killers of the Flower Flycatcher.
They want you for Captain America.
But actually, it's like, what matters? Do you know what I mean? And it's, I'm saying this with ease. But it's not easy.
No.
And
it's also
even,
practice, isn't it?
It's practice. And even now, there are times when it's tough. You know, I've had experiences this year where actually it's been really difficult finding that balance. And actually, sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I get it wrong. And I make terrible mistakes. And I look back and I think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have taken that job because... Yeah. It screwed everything up.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
but also that's the path you're on, and that's those are the, and it's like,
yeah.
Hopefully, it means that those things that you maybe people will come back to you if you turn them down.
Yeah.
Maybe later on, actually, the ones you did take will lead to something else. Like you don't really know. I think that's the thing, isn't it?
You don't know. You don't know. But also, it's and this is a really bitter pill, I think, for actors to swallow, is that because it's freelance. Because for many actors, it feels like a calling because we're dealing with art and creativity. It's very easy for us all to get quite unintentionally selfish.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
But this is my big break. This is the thing that I've been working towards. And actually, if you're on your own, fine, do what you want. But actually, as soon as it starts to impact on other people, on loved ones, on children, on other commitments, then you really need to weigh up those options.
Yeah.
And it's really tough. Mm. I mean, it is tough.
So speaking about working towards, I guess really we're at the sort of stage of the interview where we really reach the absolute scene. And where we're going to talk about your absolute scene. So for our listeners, for our listeners and for psychos.
It's the first time this is happening.
This is where we get our guests to talk about their absolute scene. So now for Psychat, he's going to explain to us what the scene is, where it's from, who it's by, just give a little bit of background, and then tell us why it is his absolute scene.
Okay. So this was really tough. This was really tough. And I've been thinking about it a lot. You know.
Thank you.
Been thinking about it while while I'm on stage and I should be doing something. I've been thinking, what's
that
absolute scene? he knows. And actually, there were a lot of candidates for this because I love theatre. And yeah, I had to go theatre purist. I had to go. That's something on stage. At one point, I thought of people, places and things. There's a
Have you seen it this time
around? I haven't seen it this time around. I saw it when it went on tour, and it wasn't with Denise, but it was phenomenal. And the staging, there was a moment when suddenly all of, you know, it feels like she splinters into loads of people. Just amazing. There's also a Peter Wallen play called Herbal Bed, where I just remember the actor playing, I think it wasn't Lorcan Cranitch, he was in it, it was someone else, saying a line about, you know, man is such a seesaw thing, 1 minute up, 1 minute down. And it stayed with me. But actually, it's neither of those. They're like the runners up. So if it's all right,
please,
I will. Well, the play is Skylight, mm-hmm, by David Hare.
Yeah.
I know it was on at the National recently, but I didn't see that. I saw the original with
incredible
Michael Gambon and Leah Williams.
Oh, bless. Brilliant.
And this was back when I was either at drama school or I just graduated, and I was trying to see as much theatre as I could with my limited budget. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, basically, in my early 20s, I only spent money on theatre tickets.
Yeah. I did the same thing. You know,
that's like,
I was like, I have to feed myself with theatre.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is, that production is like over 25 years ago, I think.
Mm.
Right? It is as clear in my mind as the beginning of this podcast. It stayed with me. And it's right at the end of Act 1, Scene 2. If it's okay, I'm just going to read.
Please do.
Because it's not even any dialogue. David Hare can't really write dialogue. No, I'm joking, David. I am joking.
Love you, David.
You're very, very good. Not that you need my approval.
Still available for work.
You're actually doing all right. No, I mean, I love David Hare.
Yeah.
I love his plays. So it's just a stage direction, and then if it's all right, I'll talk about it.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
He's gone. He moves across the room. They take each other in their arms, and she holds him tightly, hugging him desperately and beginning to cry, shaking with grief in his arms. He puts his hand through her hair. Right. So that's the stage direction. The reason it stayed with me is the actual play was great, and it was tight and tense and funny and all of those things at all moments. But I saw Michael Gambon basically burst into tears on stage, and he kind of cried like I can only assume is like a wounded panda, right? There was something totally unexpected and yet totally believable, totally natural. It's something I'd never seen before, that display of emotion in that way, but I believed it utterly.
Specifically by a male actor, or are you talking?
No, just in general. I'd never seen anyone cry like that. I mean, possibly my father, when, because my parents came over to this country from Bangladesh, if relatives ever came over.
Mm.
I remember actually after my father's mother died, all three grandparents came over in quick succession over the space of 18 months. We had them living with us. And every time my parents went to pick up a grandparent, I remember them suddenly bursting into tears in the airport. And actually, you know, I was mortified and embarrassed, but it was just true emotion. Now, the reason I chose this moment, and the reason it stuck with me, is it's something that I really strive for. And I'm not saying in any way that I come close to that, but it's the goal is to achieve something that is at once absolutely truthful but also unexpected. And by that, there is nothing in this world which is more surprising and more like out of our understanding than human beings. the sudden displays of emotions in airports, or the sudden frustration in traffic, or the sudden emotion that just comes out at the drop of a hat. And it's like, where's that come from? Well, that's actually, that's trauma that's buried deep from 16 years ago. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the body stores it, and it's that trigger that brings it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And the thing that really struck me watching that as a young actor was, wow, where has that come from? Where has that come from? And it moved me beyond. I mean, it's stayed with me all these years. And also, even though I totally believed it, I never experienced that. And like 25 years later, I have experienced those moments where it's like, I don't know why I'm crying. I'm just suddenly crying. You get that. We all get that. And it's the kind of knife edge that we exist on as actors on stage, because you take the script, assuming you have a script. Obviously, Bristol has a good devising scene, but even that generally ends up with a script. You take the script, you learn the lines, you learn the moves. So you're doing something you've done 100 times before, but you're doing it for the first time. Well, there is a total contradiction there.
Yeah.
And that moment of him, and I remember his hand was just shaking as he was crying. And I was like, oh my God, the emotion that is radiating. And I don't know, I never met Michael Gambon before he died. I don't know what his process is. You know, I don't know if he decided, oh, I'm just gonna give him something amazing. But it didn't feel like that. It felt like he was in the moment. Yeah. I don't feel like you should ever try and play emotion on stage. I feel like you play the action and everything else comes out of that. But wow, I mean, it was, and that's the thing. It's like, as an actor, I mean, also, like, you can only be as good as the opportunities you're given. You can only be as good as the part that is written, or, you know, you can elevate it to an extent, but you know, there's only so much you can polish a Farquhar. but actually, that's the thing of actually saying, I want to be the most truthful I can in the moment. And I want to be unexpected. I want to surprise myself. You know, as I'm talking to you, I don't know what the end of this sentence is, but it's going to come out. Well, that's it, isn't it? It's like, we know what the end of the sentence is, but how do you know it,
how do you trick
not
yourself
know it?
Into,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it has to go into your subconscious somehow,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah. I remember an interview that Anthony Hopkins gave, again, I think I was at university, so it was before drama school, and he said, I learned the lines so rigorously that they just fall out of my mouth. I don't need to think about it. And you can see that when you watch it. You know, certainly like Remains of the Day or Howard's End or Silence of the Lambs, it's just
yeah, you're not searching.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he reads it 20 times before he's...
Yeah. Even, yes.
As in reads the play, his lines, or the film.
And
or
I think, why wouldn't you? I think also, like, that's something that I've been implementing, and it is that thing of going, if I'm not going in already knowing this back to front, even at the beginning of rehearsals, then...
Though, I mean...
But everyone's process is different, found that really useful.
Yeah. I did a film with Anthony Hopkins this year, and I heard through the grapevine, I didn't end up actually filming with him, I heard through the grapevine that he gets the script, he gets all the grammar taken out. So there's no commas, full stops. It's totally blank. It's just the words.
No stage directions?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. So that nothing else is
on it,
and he can just learn the words, and then they can come out how they come out.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's true. If it is true, you heard it here first. If it's not true, I'm not liable. It's not
that sounds
cast.
Very like Meisner
yeah.
based, yeah. actually. And yeah. I would agree. I think that's yeah. really useful. And for you, do you feel like you've ever achieved that? What techniques do you like? Is there anything you implement that you find really useful?
So I don't know if I've ever achieved it. In a way, I hope I haven't, because I want to keep on searching.
That's the
searching.
Goal.
This, yeah. I think, so one of the things I try and do on stage is, what I don't do is I don't kind of think, right, oh, I'm bored, I'm gonna do something totally different. Because I don't think that's fair on fellow actors, but also, you know, you've rehearsed it how you've rehearsed it for a reason. You've got the understanding.
You might throw them off.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I do try and do is I try and think, okay, I might play a different colour or a different aspect. So, you know, for example, if the line's, no, sorry, I don't think you should stay. I just want you to leave now. You know, is it urgency? I just want you to leave now. Is it, I actually want you to stay? And so it's conflicted. All these things that are just tiny things that might not be discernible to the audience, but actually are just giving a different flavour.
And are still truthful to the character
yeah,
you've created
yeah.
and
obviously,
all the rehearsal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got
but
to,
you can find all of that within.
You can.
Yeah.
You can. You absolutely can.
Because it's within all of us, so it's yeah. within all the characters.
And also, if you're listening, hopefully, you know, the actors may give you, you know, you might hear something different in a line. The play that we're doing at the moment, Chance of Science, there are lines where actors are literally saying, you know, we're coming to the last week, and for the first time I heard that word, and I suddenly realised the significance of that word.
Amazing. Well, yeah, like, that's, yeah.
That's great. Beautiful.
Great.
So, so we're sort of coming to the conclusion. Boo! But we haven't.
That was an incredible absolute scene, though. That was so specific,
yes.
And I love
yeah.
that it was just a stage direction, not yeah. even like a yeah. monologue. Like, mwah.
And I think it was incredibly beautiful how you told it as well, and how you explained what it meant to you. So thank you,
Turns
thank
out,
you for sharing that.
He is a storyteller.
Yeah. Oh,
who would
what?
Have thought? Oh my God!
Would you? So for our listeners, for us as well, mm-hmm. Maybe even for yourself, would you recommend acting as a career choice?
Ooh.
Oh, well.
Bearing in mind you have a child in theatre as well.
I do. So here's what I would say. It's really tough. You have to be resilient. You have to get rid of your ego. You know, and none of these things are easy things to do. But if you feel there is nothing else you can do with your life, then you probably have to go for it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'd be a hypocrite if I said, no, don't do it.
Become an accountant.
But also you have... do you know what? It's really hard, because if you're, especially if you're young or if you're new to it, you kind of, you're starry-eyed. And actually, we all were, and that's part of the thing that hooks you in. That's part of the process you go through. But what I would say is go in with your eyes open as much as you can. It's there are going to be lows as much as there are going to be highs. And also, if you can, as I was saying before, if you can take a step back and realize that being an actor is so important to me. It's what I've chosen to do with my life outside of my family. Right, I've spent more time being an actor than probably any other thing in my life, other than being part of a family. But it isn't the only thing in life. If you can get that balance, if you can take that step back and say, when I get those no's, I'm gonna feel sad, but I'm gonna know that it's no for now. Tomorrow is another day. If you can do that, then yeah, go for it. I mean, obviously, if you're the same casting as me, it's probably not for you.
Just step away now.
Exactly.
I have one more question,
yep.
if it's all right with you, sir. And you might not have an answer to this. What is the one question you wish people would ask you? And then please answer it as well.
Oh, that's a very, very good question.
Because I feel like you've done a lot of interviews and there must be something that never gets asked.
Do you know what? I don't know. I don't know what the one question is. There's probably lots of questions. There's, you know, probably questions around casting and opportunities and all that kind of stuff. I guess, though, a nice question would be, like, how would you like to be remembered? And actually, it was a decent actor. He was a decent writer. Actually, he was a really nice bloke.
Yeah.
Because that goes a long way. I mean, in a very mercenary way, you don't want to be... You don't want to spend your time working with Farquhars. you want to be surrounded by nice people. But also, if you can help to create joy in a room, everyone benefits.
Yeah, of course. No, absolutely.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Saike, thank you ever so much for coming in. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, this has been incredible.
Yeah, it's,
like,
been,
genuinely. It's
been a real pleasure.
You're very lucky you were our first guest.
Yes! Pick first at school.
Well, thank you ever so much for coming in. Best of luck for
what's next
in store. You'd have to tell us. Also, because when this goes out, you may have already done it.
Do you want to know what's next?
If you're allowed to tell us.
Are you allowed to tell us?
So do I. I want to know.
And that's the reality of acting.
Yeah. Ooh, reality check.
But do you find, Psycat, you're on socials. Psycat socials will be linked to this episode and linked to us in the comments and things below this, be it whether you're watching this on YouTube or which we will have... we will be doing, but also if you're listening on Spotify, it will be linked in the comments to that as well. So thank you again. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this episode. We will leave you now, but I've been Andy Barton.
I've been Gabrielle Shepherd.
And I'm Psychiat Ahmed.
And this has been Absolute Scenes. We will see you next week. Thank you very much.
Bye. Great show.
You've been listening to Absolute Scenes, written and hosted by Andy Barton and Gabrielle Shepherd.
Produced by Synchron Productions in association with the Bristol Old Vic Theatre.
Music by Brian Hargreaves.
Marketing and communications by Dylan Tozer, Amanda Adams and Gabrielle Shepherd.
Please like and subscribe in all the usual ways, depending on the platform that you're devouring this on.
We've also set up a page on Buy Me a Coffee, where if you feel so inclined, you can become a supporter of the pod and help us and our guests. But honestly, we're really glad to be in your ears, so absolutely no pressure.
And tune in next time, where it will be much the same, but different, like each of my visits to my barbers.